Basically, what we do is we lend out our money to the bank. And by signing a contract, the money that you owned before, right? If it would have been cash in your hand, you would have owned it. The bank now actually owns it contractually. And the number in your bank account you see on your app becomes a claim on a certain amount of money that you've basically lent out to the bank. And now what the bank does with that is they use that as collateral for creating loans. And it's not like, you know, if you put $1,000 in the bank, that they are able to lend out $1,000 more, right? So you put $1,000 in the bank, you maybe get, I don't know, 1 or 2% on your savings account. And the bank's business model is to lend out that same money for more than 2%. And the difference is how they make money. It's called fractional reserve banking, not full reserve banking, right? Because they can use your $1,000 and lend out $10,000 for 6% per loan. And it's all based on the assumption that not everyone wants all their money at the same time. And that assumption is based on the fact that they don't really tell anyone how banking works, or don't really tell anyone what money should philosophically be, right? Like what the characteristics it should have, or the function that it fulfills. So it's all based on certain assumptions, but also lack of education or either misinformation, however you want to determine it. So like not fully understanding why any individual person would actually participate in the banking system. It is not to keep your money safe. It's to use your money that you earned by spending your time and energy to make more money for the bank.
Hello guys, welcome once again to BitCorner Podcast. Today, we're pivoting once again. I promise you this season is going to be like this. We're pivoting English to Spanish, so I promise more episodes in Spanish. Yeah. I hope that you have enjoyed the episode with Christian. We have learned a lot about the Arhuacos and how they have been orange-pilling this community in Colombia. I mean, there's a lot of things to learn about these tribes. I actually learned that there's a lot of tribes in Colombia, but also in Latin America, and not just there, also in the global south, like in India and Nepal. So there's communities in it, and we have learned how Bitcoin is so powerful and how it can help them in daily basis. But today we will continue, and today we pivot to English. And today is going to be an interesting episode. I don't want to make a long introduction because today we had someone that is also a millennial like me. And he also is a host of a podcast. Actually, it's called Bitcoin for Millennials. So Bran Kenstein, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thank you. Yeah. Unfortunately, my Spanish is very bad. If it was good, I would have loved to do it in Spanish. But sorry, it's English this time.
But I know that you want to go to El Salvador, so it's a good incentive to to learn.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, normally I'll do this thing that sometimes go straight to the point, sometimes no. But one time, a few times this season, people told me, you don't give much opportunity to your guests to introduce themselves. So now I'm doing it by default. So you can give a little bit about your background for people. I don't know.
Yeah.
That probably haven't seen your show.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that is, it's always interesting because then I always think like, okay, what should I tell, right? But I've given myself the label of a creative entrepreneur, and how I apply or have applied that in my life, I think is being in the digital world a lot. So I would say I'm a creative digital entrepreneur, but I've always really enjoyed, yeah, just being at the forefront of new technology, trying out new products, startups, apps, stuff like that. And I think by, just trying to be at that forefront constantly, I just, learned how to internet or something like that, right? And
absolutely.
Yeah, just find a lot of interesting not only opportunity, but also knowledge and skills just through, using the internet. What it's originally for, in my opinion, is the democratization of knowledge, right? And information. I've been doing that for, over 20 years now, right? Since I was younger and I got internet at home. Yeah, just trying to learn every day, basically. And I've applied that interest and skill in many different ways. I've worked on many different ideas, failed at many different ideas, sold a few things along the way. I had some corporate experience in TradFi. I had my own marketing agency. Now I'm building two apps with AI, for example. And yeah, like you said,
in
Claude, yeah, for sure. And I think along the way, you know, like 2014, I found Bitcoin. I always share, you know, I bought between $100 and $300. So I sold it all at $4,000, which was really great because I was a student. But looking back, you know, a dumb decision, obviously. Also, when I look back at old tweets where I say things like, you know, this is 2014. I'm saying things like Bitcoin is a synthesized digital commodity that you can trade with anyone in the world. It's decentralized, blah, 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 you know, all these things. And I'm like, you know, I got it, but I didn't get it. And it took me a lot of years and, you know, stupid ICOs and NFT and crypto nonsense to eventually just realize that Bitcoin is an incredibly special computer science discovery, which is extremely important for the world and that we should put our attention towards. And that's eventually what I decided to do. So I started the Bitcoin for Millennials podcast now 2.5 years ago, almost at 250 episodes. And yeah, basically talk to almost everyone who's inspired me along the way, which is just really fun to do and something that I've learned a lot from and also happy to see that, yeah, it's helping other people to discover and understand Bitcoin and maybe even more importantly, why it exists. So yeah. I hope that's a good summary, a quick summary.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we have basically almost the same background. I also started with cryptos. I started a little bit later than you in 2017. But yeah, it's like you. I got it, but I understand the concept, but until I truly start orange peeling myself, you know, the COVID pandemic, because basically we were in lockdown, so there was not much to do. Mm-hmm. Saifedean was releasing his book. You know, Max and Stacey had their show in RTE, so I learned a lot with them. Yeah, and actually I came to the same conclusion as you. So, but I want to ask you also about your show. So maybe, I think my question would be like, when you started the show, first, what is the purpose of the show? What is your goal? Mm-hmm. And what was your aha moment, or do you have like a process of aha moments in Bitcoin?
Oh wow! Well, so I think the purpose of the podcast is, you know, it's Bitcoin for Millennials, and it's because I realized that a few things. I think this was in a period where I was talking to some Bitcoin people that I knew from online, like from X or whatever. We would have like calls like this, and just, you know, talk with each other, explore, talk about Bitcoin, whatever. And quite a few times where we thought like, oh, this was actually a really nice conversation. Like we should have recorded this and then we can share it with others. So that's kind of how a seed was planted. But at the same time, in the same period, I was talking to a lot of millennial friends and people I've known for a long time. Some people that have been very successful in business and don't have to work again at, you know, in mid 30s, and people that I admire or look up to, love, think are intelligent and whatnot. And they totally don't understand it. They don't understand Bitcoin. They don't understand the problem they have. They're totally oblivious, even though they are intelligent, right? They are totally oblivious to, the debasement of money, what the consequences are, you know, fiat money system, fractional reserve banking, stuff like that. They just have no clue and or, yeah, are not really even interested to learn about it. And I think those moments together kind of motivated me to do something for my generation, because I do think we need Bitcoin, right? I mean, just the idea that, you know, if you're mid-30s and you want to retire in 30 years, how much money units do you need? And if in 30 years at 2% inflation, half of the purchasing power disappears, this question becomes even more difficult to answer. And it becomes even more difficult to answer when you know that it's not 2% a year, it's even more and it's increasing, etc. So I think understanding that there is a certain problem in your future is one, but then also getting to a point where you want to act upon it today and actually try to figure out how you can do that. I mean, my answer is Bitcoin, obviously, but I do think that everyone goes through their own journey of gathering knowledge and reflecting and accepting and denying and all these things along the way. that you cannot understand it for someone else. They have to do it themselves. So that, and that also combined with, you know, every generation has had a certain asset that has helped them propel forward that other people didn't really see or had the opportunity to, right? So like the boomers had real estate and Gen X had like index funds, S&P 500, stuff like that. And I think millennials have Bitcoin. That's just what I think. Should Bitcoin exist for millennials? You know, someone told me once, I met him and he said, you know, I think the name of your podcast is brilliant. And I said, why? Because I'm just trying to niche down, right? Like I want to help my generation. He's like, yeah, because it shouldn't exist. Like Bitcoin for millennials should exist. Millennials shouldn't even need Bitcoin in order to prepare for and have hope for their future. And I just thought it was very interesting. Like I never thought about it like that, but I do agree with it. It's kind of crazy that everything that has kind of been taught or sold to us, right, as to how your path of life goes, you kind of get stuck in your mid-30s, right, or earlier mid-30s. When you realize, okay, maybe I can't buy a home or I can't start a family, although I want to. It's all these things you thought you would achieve in the future that you might not achieve. Okay, so what do you do about that, right? Like how can you take on a certain agency to try to figure out what is going on and then how to mitigate that for yourself? So that's, you know, the motivation behind the podcast. And I think, you know, I've had several aha moments along the way. It's hard to pinpoint them or like how they work together. But yeah. I think one of the biggest, I'll share two of the biggest moments. One was when I was 30 and I had a mortgage and I was already into Bitcoin and I was working at a bank, like the biggest bank of my country. I used to be in Amsterdam, going into the skyscraper every day with my little Bitcoin pin on my backpack and, you know, feeling like an intruder. But it took me a conversation with a colleague who told me, did you know the money in the bank is not yours? And I was like, what are you talking about? And then we had lunch for an hour and he like fully explained it to me. And I just remember walking away from that conversation, just feeling like an idiot, like just realizing that I wasn't an actor, that I was a subject in a system that I just had no clue about how it worked. Even though, again, I was working at a bank, I was participating, I had a mortgage, you know, I was into Bitcoin. I thought like, oh, I'm a knowledgeable person, but I wasn't.
I need to pause on this because your people and my people are millennials, so probably as you had this question for the first time that someone told you that the money you put it in the bank is not yours, if you can summarize like why actually is that true?
Well, it's also not money and it's also not in a bank, right?
Yeah.
Well, this whole idea of fractional reserve banking is like I think a lot of people have this idea that the bank is like a big vault and there is money that is stored in this vault and you're paying the bank to safeguard it or something, right? Like they just think it's like a giant vault. So the cash money like 100 years ago isn't under your bed or something like that. That's kind of the idea that we have. But basically what we do is we lend out our money to the bank. And by signing a contract, the money that you owned before, right? If it would have been cash in your hand, you would have owned it. The bank now actually owns it contractually. And the number in your bank account you see on your app becomes a claim on a certain amount of money that you've basically lent out to the bank. And now what the bank does with that is they use that as collateral for creating loans. And it's not like, you know, if you put $1,000 in the bank, that they are able to lend out $1,000 more, right? So you put $1,000 in the bank, you maybe get, I don't know, 1 or 2% on your savings account. And the bank's business model is to lend out that same money for more than 2%. And the difference is how they make money. It's called fractional reserve banking, not full reserve banking, right? Because they can use your $1,000 and lend out $10,000 for 6% per loan. And it's all based on the assumption that not everyone wants all their money at the same time. And it's funny because that assumption...
Except in crisis time.
Exactly, right? So that's why this time is also interesting.
Yeah.
And that assumption is based on the fact that they don't really tell anyone how banking works. Or don't really tell anyone what money should philosophically be, right? Like what the characteristics it should have or the function that it fulfills. So it's all based on certain assumptions, but also lack of education or either misinformation, however you want to determine it. So like not fully understanding why any individual person would actually participate in the banking system. It is not to keep your money safe. It's to use your money that you earned by spending your time and energy to make more money for the bank, right? And if the bank messes up, or well, if it goes well, you never hear anything, right? Because they are making money. If it goes wrong and the bank blows up or goes bust, whatever, what happens is, you know, so they privatize the gains. That's what it's called, right? And they socialize the losses. So if it goes bad, you are still, you're not an owner of that money. You become a creditor of that money, right? And there are certain things like insurance deposits from a state, for example, that say like, you know, each bank account has up to $250,000 of insurance backed by the state, whatever. But the state can just print in, they can create infinite money units, right? So in a nominal way, it is true that you are covered. But eventually, when a government has to step in, there's two options. They either create more money units, they inflate the supply of money, which eventually creates inflation of prices. So that hurts citizens. Or the other way is, you know, how does a state get money is by raising taxes or get more taxes. So that also touches the citizens. I cannot find it quickly, but I have a really cool thread on X with Grok where we talk through this. And I ask Grok like, okay, but what label would you put on citizens that put their money in a bank? Like, what are they technically in this scheme, right? And it said something like they're not covered. So they are debtors, but they're not covered, basically, or creditors, but they are not covered. Oh, okay. Right? So I said, okay, that kind of sounds like a scam or a Ponzi, right? Because the conditions are not clear. And then it said, you know, well, it has all the characteristics of a Ponzi. It is legal. That was the reply. It is legal. So I think
there's no difference.
No, there's no difference. I'll share two other things, like legal coverage for what a bank should have of all the deposits in America is zero. And in Europe, it's 1%. So even if this entire scheme wouldn't even exist, if 100 people want to get their money, legally, the bank can give zero people their money in the US. And in Europe, it can be 1%. I don't know how much what they actually have. But they never have the 100%, right? So I think, and this would be my main thing, is the first thing you need to realize in your entire Bitcoin journey, and again, this was one of my big aha moments, is that this is how it works. And that you have to make a decision if you want to participate in something like this or not, with all the contingencies and all the dependencies and the outsourcing of responsibility that all come with it, and your perceived risk or assurance by participating in this system, right? And I think if you really sit with that question, even though the other direction, right, where the answer is no, I don't want to participate in it, but I have no clue what to do because everyone is participating in this, right? That may sound more scary until you find Bitcoin, I would say. Because once you realize that you can, if you try to add value and you earn money as a reward, and you are able to live in a certain way that you can save an excess of money, right? That is your capital, your pooled money. You have one system where you can park that works like I just described, and you are literally a subject to whatever happens. Or you can move it into a system, which is Bitcoin, right? It's just a parallel system. Just visualize it as like a thing that you can take and move, basically. Once you realize that there is a form of digital money that anyone can adopt, anyone can verify for themselves. There is no third party that, you know, this is what I asked one of my rich friends that sold their company. I'm like, okay, if you call the bank and you say $200,000 from the bank, cash, you know, what do you think happens? And he's like, yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe they ask when I need it or whatever. I don't think they have it. I said, no, the first question by, you know, random phone person number one is going to be 200,000. It's a bit more than, let me see. Oh, 10,000. You know, what are you going to use it for? It's going to be the first question. And they don't even know why they're asking, because they have to do that, you know, because of their central bank tells them. And I said this to my friend, and he was looking at me like, yeah, okay, I don't know. Like, I don't really care. And I'm like, dude, there is, you do not own what you think you own, right? This is not your property.
Absolutely.
There's a random person on the other side of the phone that is asking you why you need it. Like, what?
It's my money. What do you care?
Well, yeah, it's not.
Yeah, yeah, right? I mean, obviously.
So conceptually, you would think it's your money, but yeah, it's not.
Exactly.
Right? And this is the first path. This is the first decision you have to make. We're not even at Bitcoin yet, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to really think about, okay, do I want to keep participating in a system that I can never truly understand, but I know is not designed for my individual prosperity, or am I going to try to figure out what else I need to do?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that I think you also approach in your podcast. I mean, I'll focus a lot in what is the problem, because if people can understand what is the problem, like broken money, a broken system, then they can start understanding and asking more questions, and eventually they will go to Bitcoin. Another thing that I want to ask you is that you have done a lot of episodes just like me. And I'm just thinking that this week, just by chance, I had someone that is a boomer. Actually, I have Bob Burnett, probably you know him, that he has the Bitcoin boomers.
He was my inspiration to start the podcast, actually.
Really?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
So before it became a podcast, like the calling, the call or the motivation to do something came from Bob Burnett.
This is more well, man.
Yeah. 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 So he was on a podcast and he shared something like, you know, I think Bitcoin is probably the most important like technological development or thing that you could spend your time and energy on. Because even if you don't think, well, like this is going to be something you're going to think about for the rest of your life. And yeah, I agreed when I heard that. Like, yeah. So I want to see how this plays out. I want to see how this plays out. So if I think this should truly exist and more people should understand it, then that was basically my call to action by Bob. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I do want to contribute to this. I didn't know how, but yeah, like I explained like later.
No, so my question was that just by chance, it seems this week I have been recording one episode with a boomer, one episode with a millennial, that is you. Yeah. And the next one is going to be someone from Gen Z. So it's nice. Like the perfect combination to do this. So my question is like, because you also have done a lot of episodes, that what do you think that our generation makes the big difference between Gen Z and boomers, but in terms that what we're fighting for, what we're struggling, I think the things that they were struggling, our parents, is not the same as us. Mm. And of course, the solution could be the same, Bitcoin, right? But what do you think is one of the biggest challenge for us as millennials in our daily basis?
Cuando dejas tus activos digitales en un exchange o en custodia de alguien más, te expones a riesgos de terceros no deseados. A diferencia del sistema bancario tradicional, Bitcoin te permite tomar el control total de tus fondos utilizando tus propias claves privadas. Esto te permite ser soberano y esencialmente tu propio banco. Al tomar el control de tus Bitcoin, puedes evitar riesgos innecesarios de terceros. Almacenar tus Bitcoin en custodia de terceros como los exchanges puede exponerte a ataques de actores malintencionados, gobiernos o estafadores que lo único que quieren es apoderarse de tu dinero. Las billeteras de hardware aumentan la seguridad de tu billetera porque tus claves privadas se almacenan en un dispositivo especializado que no está siempre conectado al internet. Como te he dicho antes, mantener tus claves almacenadas en un dispositivo en línea puede exponerte a factores adicionales de ataque, por lo que se recomienda usar una billetera de hardware al almacenar grandes cantidades de Bitcoin durante largos periodos de tiempo. Jade es una billetera de hardware no custodial para Bitcoins y Liquid que ofrece opciones de firma simple y firmas múltiples. Yo personalmente lo utilizo para almacenar mis bitcoins, ya que me siento mucho más seguro manteniendo mis bitcoins en una billetera fría que en una almacenada, por ejemplo, en mi teléfono. Si estás pensando en adquirir uno para ti, no olvides utilizar el código de descuento de nuestro show, BitCorner Podcast. De esta forma estarás apoyando directamente el show y además obtendrás un 10% de descuento para la compra de tu billetera fría.
This podcast is brought to you by Bull Bitcoin, the most trusted Bitcoin-only exchange, built by Bitcoiners or Bitcoiners who give a damn about sovereignty, not altcoins, no custody, just per Bitcoin straight to your wallet. Get your own virtual event so banks can spy on your Bitcoin activity. Buy Bitcoin instantly or send bank transfer to Canada, Europe, Mexico, and Argentina in a snap. For pennies, ditch the banks, screw the shady remittances apps. Head to boldbitcoin.com, use the code BitCornerPodcast, and start stacking sats in the right way, or send money home cheap and fast. Bold Bitcoin. Own your money, destroy fear.
I think it starts with, you know, the millennials now are in an age range, let's say late 20s to late 30s, where they are making or have made some big decisions in their life, right? Like where to live or who to be with or getting children or you know, whatever your kind of like career direction is or whatnot. So, but at the same time, you know, like I said before, I think we're realizing that the path that we embarked on kind of changed mid-game or doesn't really exist anymore. And I think that is a very confusing thing to realize in a sense. And I think it also, you know, there are people that don't want to have children, for example, because they are uncertain about the future or they think it's too expensive. I could never afford that. That's crazy. Like your parents who were, you know, in Western Europe, who were born from people that survived a world war, were dying to have kids. Everyone wanted to have kids, right? Like they were literally the boomer generation.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why they're called the boomer generation.
Yeah. And they have all the incentives to have them.
They had less wealth, country in shambles, right? Country needing to be rebuilt. Very bad situation, and they all did it. Of course, I didn't live back then, and maybe there was different motivation. But I think the thing now is the fact that you are discouraged from having children, right? Like following your biological urge by a man-made construct that is stealing your time and energy, and therefore, in some crazy way, your spirit is just one of the most messed up things I think exists. Like the biggest spiritual crime of fiat money is that.
Yeah.
And so I think what the millennials feel is that, you know, the boomers are okay. They might be messed up in some, yeah, but I mean, like they're going to be okay. At least they have a paid off house, right? Like at some point they're going to be okay. It's not the future. I think is not without challenges for them, but they're going to be okay. And they're closer to death. So to say, right. I think no,
Bob,
but like,
hear that.
No. I love Bob. Shout out to Bob. I think like for the millennial, for the Gen Z, they feel and they see what is happening, but they do have the most time, right? And I think like they have time to change paths or even create a different path, right? Or just change the whole notice of what the path looks like in their lives, etc. I mean, a lot of Gen Zers are waking up to the fact that the phone is a fucking enslavement, and they're buying dumb phones and stuff. I mean, they're waking up to that themselves, right? I see people on YouTube that are like 19. They say like, I sat on my floor and I did nothing for 2 hours. There's YouTube videos of Gen Zers figuring out fucking meditation, right? Like they're figuring it out not by reading about meditation or esoteric knowledge or whatever. They're figuring it out because their brain needs it. They just don't want to, you know. So it's so funny how this counter thing exists.
Pure passive dopamine.
Yeah. So I think they will be fine too. I think they will be fine too. Although part of their future idea has definitely changed, but I think they'll be fine. I think one of the biggest challenges for millennials is that you're in this midlife, right? You're in this midlife where all these big decisions are, and the game changed. Okay, so do I have enough time to create a different path to understand the new game? Well, I mean, I already have kids, or I already made this decision or whatever. So I think that it just becomes way more apparent to millennials that there is this huge problem towards the future. I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but that's kind of how I view it. It's like you're kind of stuck in the middle. You made all these big decisions. You have time more than boomers, but less than these others, right? Like, okay, so how do you mitigate this realization that the game changed mid-game and you're probably not even in the same game anymore. You cannot even define the game that you're in, if that makes sense, right? So I think that all together is very confusing, especially, and I'll end with that, because I think millennials, again, especially in the West, right? I mean, that's my point of view.
Yeah.
We grew up in the best time to ever grow up of anyone who ever lived. So
yeah.
And money just worked, and there was water and food and a roof over our head and whatnot. And so our idea of this life path is also based on that really great time. And that's, you know, it's not to complain or whatever, but it was our expectation that life would continue like this, right? And if you again figure out that it's not at, let's say, about halfway through your life, that's big, right? Like that's not a nice realization. I think it's a very big and unpleasant realization, which proposes a real challenge.
Yeah. No, I was asking this because I was thinking also for the next generation, for example, the Gen Z or the ones that continue after them, because, you know, El Salvador are doing this huge path that, as you know, Bukele is not putting, let's say, all the efforts in our generation. He is putting the efforts in the youngest one, in the kids, the people that are in the kids that are in school, because our path right now, it's they have the chance to learn about Bitcoin in public schools, but also they're focusing on AI a lot. So I think that's the most important thing to learn right now, because I think those are the tools that will provide them an advantage compared to the rest. Because I think that every generation had an advantage. I think ours was that we were between the analogical things and the digital ones, because we grew up in the streets, but also when the era of the computing started, right? So we adapted really fast. But the next generations, they have another challenge that is going to be Bitcoin and AI, right? So I think it's an on-road, but we're there. And I don't know, do you think that this could be also the path for Europe or the Eastern? Because I get in the Global South, for example, we are in huge need. But what I'm trying to say here is that how can you apply Bitcoin in daily basis for anyone that it's a normal millennial that there's are not in need, right? So in the Global South, we have...
Yeah. Well, it's an amazing question, and I talked about it with someone on my podcast today. I always kind of prided myself with the fact that, you know, I figured out Bitcoin without actually experiencing the problem, if that makes sense, right? Like, that's always what I felt like. That's quite an achievement. But later I figured out, you know, people that actually have the problem today of crazy fiat debasement, right? Or for, I don't know, you live in the history of your country or the history of Argentina, or, you know, like you said, wherever in many Global South places, you don't have time and space to think about this, right? You're just surviving.
Just one shot.
And you're right. Yeah. You're hustling, you're trying to survive and doing whatever. And I'm just sitting here, you know, crazy, comfortable philosophizing about, you know, what is money? So it's nonsense that I thought this was an achievement that I made, right? Because I had the luxury to actually have time and space and contemplate and think about, you know, what the hell is going on. So I think that's also been one of my biggest insights, is that I always thought, you know, also coming from my background, like, if you have a startup idea or a business idea, the first people you want to find is the people that have a problem, are aware of the problem, actually want to solve their problem. That's a very important one, right? Are also open to paying for the solution because they understand that the solution will be more valuable than whatever the cost is, and that they want to buy it from you, that you can actually reach them and talk to them, right? But this first part, people that have the problem, is not so difficult. Everyone has the fiat money problem, right? Are you aware of that? Very dependent on where you live and what your perception is of the people that create the environment that you live in, right? If you're okay, then you don't have a problem, right? If you are not okay, then you have a problem, but then you get to the third step. Like, do you actually want to solve it, right? Do you want to fully accept that there are other people that basically steal your time and energy because they can create money from nothing and pay you for your finite time and energy? Like, are you okay with that? Can you actually get to a point where you have enough time to philosophically think through what that even means, what I said, right? And if you're hungry every day and you need to hustle and just survive, you don't, right? So I have a lot of although I have not lived that experience, I have a lot of empathy for that because I now see that is very difficult, almost impossible, right? Almost impossible. And I had this example on the podcast today. I know a guy who's from Kenya. He's like super into Bitcoin. Like 2 years ago in Kenya, there were like huge riots by young people against the government for all their financial plans and whatnot. And they ousted some minister or governor, whatever. And he's there on the ground telling all these people, you're right, you're right. Like you're totally identifying the problem, etc. You're totally right. But what you need to do now is get into Bitcoin. Like you need to take energy from the money system. The money system, if you don't take energy from the money system, that's what controls you. That's the origin of all these issues that you correctly identify. And they all think he was crazy. There's no huge Bitcoin adoption in Kenya now, although everyone now knows the problem, has pointed at the people that are doing it and whatnot. And so that's also been an interesting insight. It's like, even when the people that are experiencing the problem correctly identify the problem and they point at the right people and whatever, they still don't understand like the fundamental origin of the problem and what needs to change. And so I think what is very important to communicate is that you really need to think about that. Like, why is it so that even people in those places experiencing the actual problems, caring so much that they go out into the street and some people even die and whatnot, that they cannot even get to the source of the problem? Like, you need to see how deep this goes, like how big the fiat money enchantment or bewilderment is. Does that make sense? Right? Like just this whole notion of the money we have today is the most organic way we ended up with the best possible money of the entire history or whatever. I don't know. That's some sort of baseline assumption people have that they also never think about. And so I think when I hear stuff like this or also now talk about it, I'm just thinking like that should be the signal that it goes really, really deep. And it's really difficult to just poke through that because honestly, your whole life, you never thought about what money is. It just works. Even in a poverty stricken country, it works. You have coins and a bill and you give it to someone and they give you a banana or whatever. It just worked. Like I gave the thing and they gave me something back. Okay, this is money, right? Like it doesn't go.
What is money?
I mean, yeah, but you know, and this is, I think, the education that 99% or just the experience that 99% of the people, including myself, just have when they are younger, like, okay, this is money, whatever. And I'm never even going to think about it again.
Yeah. But you know what? That's interesting because that's the same thing that I was talking with Bob that I told him, like, I study engineering in my economic classes. All the things that I learned were Keynesians, no Austrians. No telling that, you know, there's several types of economics. Okay, maybe, yeah, they mentioned it, you know, like the philosophers and the class, but they never teach you at the same way, Austrian, at the same way that they teach you Keynesian, because all they care is that you learn to know how the banks works, right? But never explain you what is money. So
I had a guy on the podcast who has a double masters of economics. And he said, we were calculating with stuff, but we never had a philosophical discussion about what money is or should be or what its function is. And I mean, how should we figure that out then as just normal citizens, right? If a person like that never even gets to that point. And again, for me, it is a signal. It is a signal that shows you how deep it runs.
Absolutely. We're going to start wrap it up. I have a question that the audience knows. It's the game that my previous guests have a question for my next guest. You chose to know who was the guest, but you didn't choose the question. So now you're going to have it. And then we're going to wrap it up with a question of mine. So for the audience, the last guest was Christian. And he has a question in Spanish.
Entonces, cuando tú vengas a Colombia y quieras ver los arhuacos, solo busca el centro Bitcoin y ellos te van a llevar a sus lugares más sagrados, digámoslo así, o a sus lugares más personales, porque entendieron la filosofía de este cuento, lo que es Bitcoin y la gente que estamos detrás de él. Mi primer contacto con ellos fue, por ahí tengo una foto, hablarle a la sierra lo que yo iba a hacer.
Entonces, ¿ah, sí?
Estábamos todos, yo de espalda a ellos y hablarle a la sierra. Vinimos a enseñar sobre Bitcoin, es esto y esto. Y para ellos era lo primero y lo más importante. Entonces, en eso va el centro Bitcoin. Este año esperamos participar, ellos participen en varios eventos de Bitcoin con una estación de café donde puedan promover su economía circular. Y yo creo, hermano, de las cosas más importantes es que visitemos las economías circulares, que apoyemos, que de alguna manera, ¿no? Sería un ideal poderlas visitar, ir a comprarles café, ir a comprarles tejidos a las comunidades quechua, ir a Brasil, donde Pedro hace una comunidad circular y poder surfear, ir a Chile. Pero si no lo podemos hacer, seguirlas, darle un like, comentar, hacer conexiones, porque en serio necesitamos hablarnos entre nosotros, hablar esto en español, que esa es la forma de que el mensaje le va a llegar a muchas más personas. Y porque yo estoy convencido que esta es la herramienta para poder llevar muchos acceso a la educación, acceso al conocimiento, a muchas comunidades no representadas que de verdad lo necesitan y lo quieren, pero no encuentran la solución. Y a la final estas comunidades entienden mucho más fácil el mensaje, que era parte de lo que te decía ahorita, porque ellos han entendido el valor del trueque durante toda su historia. Entonces, se cambió esto por aquello, y fuera del valor oro. Entonces, cuando tú les enseñas Bitcoin, inicialmente tú crees, uy, no, estos no la van a coger. Esto es muy, si yo no pude, ellos, ustedes dicen, ah, ok, está bien, o sea, me lo pasan de aquí a aquí, listo. Y así es una particularidad de todas las comunidades indígenas que yo he podido conocer. Actualmente yo estoy haciendo una cartografía como de comunidades, coiners y economías circulares, de comunidades que todavía no son economías circulares, pero sí hay una adopción. Entonces estoy haciendo una cartografía de Latinoamérica. Ahí voy en el proceso, ahí voy.
Estaría muy bueno tenerlos, va a ser bastante útil, sobre todo para gente que quiera hacer más proyectos, replicarlo, ¿no? Eso está súper bien.
Yeah. Oh, I think this is a probably one of
stop
the best.
Sharing? Sorry.
Yeah, you stop sharing. Yes. Yeah, I see.
Okay.
I think this is probably one of the most important questions, but I think it's really hard to achieve. And I also think it'll take some time. You know, I recently had a podcast with Jeff Booth where I talked about, you know, people say like, oh, it should become a medium of exchange or else Bitcoin failed. But I think it's partially true, but I think it takes a long time for people to actually start accepting Bitcoin as something they can trade with, because you know, I think the store value function of money comes before that. Like, why would I, as someone who sells something, receive Bitcoin as a reward if I don't understand why I even need it or would want that? And I think the best use case today is not to say like, oh, this is better money. And then some people will say, well, I have coins and bills, and if I give it to this person, he gives me a banana or a lollipop or milk or whatever. Like, it works. He accepts it, right? So saying you're doing something wrong and I have a better solution is the worst pitch ever, right? So I just don't think that works today. What I do think works today, you know, if you want to plan for your future and you want to, you live in a way that you have excess money that you can save, if there's a way for you to save that capital for the future, for whenever you want to spend it on whatever, Bitcoin is the best way to do that due to its characteristics. So I think that is an easier way to explain to people why they would need Bitcoin today. And I think then over time, once more people figure that out, they will also want to earn Bitcoin. And whether that will be a circular economy or not, I think is hard to predict. But I agree that, you know, Bitcoin is basically a parallel money system. And by definition, because it has an edge, right? There's a maximum amount of Bitcoin. It is a circular economy by definition, I would say. What I like, and I think that's also what this guy is doing, right, is that there are people that are basically doing it the old school way, right? It's just community by community and connecting, you know, going from one community, connecting them with another community, and then another, and then another. I think that works locally, but eventually it also works digitally, right? And I think that is the beauty of Bitcoin, is that it is a a global decentralized money that anyone can use, right? So if you do things globally, or sorry, locally, I think it goes like how this guy is doing it, and that's a grind, right? Like that is doing the one by one person conversion by hand, basically, right? I mean, way different than doing a podcast and maybe reaching hundreds or thousands of people at the same time, right? So I think it's very admirable that people do that. And I think on the other side, if you are on the internet and you're selling stuff or doing stuff on the internet, you know, it's never been easier to accept Bitcoin. So I think just keeping on doing this is just the way to go. Maybe that's a boring answer, but you know, I think really hard. It's really hard for people to switch money.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. For what I've seen experience in my country is that at least in El Salvador was because of the need. So, I mean, El Santo was the perfect example that how it all started, right? And from there, people understood the use of Bitcoin.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. My last question then is that what is the most valuable thing that Bitcoin have given to you? For example, how it changed your way of thinking? Even I think you had to do the same thing that all Bitcoiners have done at some point in your life, that is a change your belief system. We knew that. We discovered that we were wrong.
I think. The main thing is that Bitcoin showed me that I can trust myself and my own thinking and diligence and research and reflection, and that it gave me an opportunity to start thinking for myself and experience what it is like on like just one subject, which is one of the most important subjects, probably money, right? Like it's probably the most important technology in the world, by going down that, you know, rabbit hole and realizing, like I said, you know, with that conversation with the colleague, that I was doing stuff, but I had no clue why, to then taking the decision that, you know, I was not okay with that and wanted to change something about that. And then instantly giving myself an even bigger issue, right? Like taking on the agency to try to figure out, okay, but well, if I don't want that, what do I do on this path, right? I think just doing that is already what makes Bitcoin a somewhat a spiritual experience, because it gives you the experience of thinking for yourself and choosing for yourself and taking on that agency and everything that comes with that. And I think that shines on a lot of different subjects in the rest of your life as well.
Amen. I agree with all that, man. And thank you
Isn't
very
that
much
funny?
For your time.
Isn't that funny, by the way?
The what?
That you recognize what I said. No, but that's the thing, right? Like a lot of people would agree in some way, maybe not exactly what I said, but you know, the general message. I know a lot of people have a similar experience, which is very interesting to say the least, I would say, right? Like why is that?
Yeah, for me the most impactful thing that and probably has happened to you, it is no matter where people come from. I mean, I'm talking about the our guests or even the old listeners. It doesn't matter. We all come to the same conclusion. So
yes.
Just the perspective is different, but the conclusion is always the same.
And that is what is so powerful, right? Because these people come from all sorts and walks of life, from many different places, from many different religions, skin color, preference, all that fucking shit doesn't matter in Bitcoin. And that is amazing, right? Like that is just baffling. And it goes from like rocket scientists and mathematicians and,
exactly,
you know, crazy smart people to just humble plebs, carpenters, whatever, right? Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you do or where you come from. Like the cool part is that a huge, huge diverse group of people are ending up on this conclusion. And that again is also a signal by itself, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, as I told you, for me, I think the most, hard thing to do was to change your belief system, because then you realize one, you start studying Bitcoin, it's like, damn, okay, I was wrong in so many things.
Yeah, I'm an idiot.
But it's good to realize the right
things. That's okay.
We're doing something to change it.
Exactly. Yeah, we're trying. Yeah, exactly.
We're trying our best. All right, Ron, thank you very much for your time, and I hope to do it this the second part another time.
Yeah, but thank you. Happy to be here. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you. Guys, it was all for this week. Next week we'll have a Gen Z person here, so we will have the perspective of someone from Gen Z. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. I'm learning as every single day with you. So yeah, see you on the next episode. Ciao.